Hello and welcome to the 4Press Podcast presented by GolfWeek.com. I'm your host, David Dusek, and in this episode, my very special guest is Peter Kostas. Peter, as you are well aware, is a former on-course analyst for CBS Sports, as well as the coach for Paul Casey. And in the podcast you're about to hear, my friend Peter and I talked quite a bit about Bryson DeChambeau and the evolution of his game and how much we think it may or may not influence pros and elite amateur players who have aspirations of playing on the PGA Tour. We also talk about course setup and how that dictates what players can and cannot do, not only in U.S. Opens, but also in week-to-week PGA Tour events. And we get quite a bit into the weeds with regard to Rory McIlroy and Jordan Spieth and give a way too early look ahead towards the 2020 Fall Masters. Get stronger, hit longer, and end pain with Golf Forever. Created by Justin Leonard and co-author of the Younger Next Year Back book, Dr. Jeremy James, Golf Forever is the take anywhere online golf fitness program that helps you build a body primed for golf. It's simple, safe, and it works. At home, in the gym, on the golf course, Golf Forever's easy to follow exercises, warm-up routines, and course management videos will help you play your best pain-free. Sign up today at golfforever.com and use promo code GOLFWEEK for a free 14-day trial. So now that my next guest has had a chance to process the fact that the Los Angeles Lakers are the NBA champions and now share the all-time title lead with his beloved Boston Celtics, I would like to bring Peter Kostas onto the 4Press. How you doing, Pete?
Oh, that's a great intro. I'm doing fantastically well. Thank you, David.
Well, you know, it's unfortunately the truth. It felt like it was inevitable. I don't know how much of the NBA playoffs and certainly the finals that you watched, but it never felt like, and being a Celtics fan as well, it never felt like the Lakers weren't going to win. Maybe it was the matchups that they had. Maybe it was the fact that they had two of the maybe four or five best players in basketball on the same team. But yeah, it sort of felt inevitable, didn't it?
Well, I mean, I don't know. In this age of divisiveness, I'm going to put an asterisk on this because they didn't play a full season. They didn't have the pairings lined up the way they normally would. And besides, the Celtics won a whole bunch in a row. So I still give them the all-time great lead.
Forget the whole LeBron James, Michael Jordan debate. You're still in the Bill Russell camp with all those rings. I get it. Are you getting used to seeing Tom Brady in a Tampa Bay uniform?
You know, it's really, really interesting to me as a coach and as a sports fan to see Bill Belichick maybe doing some of his best coaching ever. With this team that he has right now, given the players that he's lost, Tom Brady is Tom Brady. He's got his career credentials that are unquestionable, but you see him struggling a little bit and so on and so forth. So it's going to be really interesting for me to see how the season ends up and which one of the two of them ends up with a little bit more success.
Now, admit it a little bit to me, friend to friend, because nobody's listening. We can. When Cam Newton was announced as the quarterback for the New England Patriots, you were happy, weren't you? You were really excited.
Yes, I was.
And while obviously, you know, his coming down and being COVID-19 positive puts a damper on those things, and we hope that he gets well soon, is able to come back to the team. Do you feel that they made the right move by letting Brady go at this point? Because it seems like Brady this year for Tampa has been up and down. He does love to throw a pick six now and then, but Cam is not Brady. But it sounds like you're cool with that.
Yeah, no, and what I'm cool with is that it's just like teaching the golf swing. You know, I don't teach a golf swing. I teach the player that's in front of me, and I teach them a swing that works for them, right? And Belichick coaches his players. He doesn't coach football. He doesn't make them kind of fit into the mold that he wants. He will figure out a way and a scheme for each week for the players he has to work with. So to me, it's really interesting to watch how the offense evolves, you know, with Cam at the quarterback position as opposed to what it had evolved to with Brady under center. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's going to be fun to watch the evolution of the team when he comes back as it continues throughout the season.
Well, so speaking of evolution, we've been watching quite a bit of Bryson DeChambeau, and he caused quite a dust up a little while ago when in the first round of the Shriners Hospital for Children Open at TPC Summerlin, he goes out and shoots 62 by basically driving par four greens, making some eagles, and doing what is now, you know, Bryson type of golf. I'm assuming you had a chance to watch most of the U.S. Open, and there was a lot of talk before that about thick rough and narrow fairways and how tricky winged foot was going to be, and it was certainly very challenging for just about everybody there. What was your overall impression about the way that DeChambeau went about playing at the U.S. Open and has basically gone through this transformation in his body and his swing?
Well, I mean, there's several questions involved in that now. Number one, about winged foot. It was designed in the early 1900s. The game was played differently back then. It was primarily played along the ground. Mm-hmm. And as such, the vast majority of the greens at winged foot had areas to run the ball onto the green. That's the way golf was played back then. And so when you watch the way Bryson attacked the golf course, it really wasn't bomb and gouge golf. It was bomb and gouge and roll it on the green. You know, he wasn't forced to carry bunkers or water hazards or whatever and land the ball on the green out of that rough. He could hack it out of there, land it 10, 15, 20 yards short and have it roll on. And we saw a lot of players doing that. So I think he took advantage of the architectural weaknesses of the golf course. He really did his homework and figured out that, okay, I can run this on here. Maybe the flag will be located there, and I'll hit it close, or if it won't, I'll two-putt from 30 feet and go on to the next hole. So, you know, I think when we get into this discussion about distance and Bryson and the effect it's going to have going forward, we can't discount the impact of architecture on how the game is played today as well.
I think it's a valid point. Clearly, Bryson is a thoughtful young man. He put a lot of thought into the way that he set up his body and his equipment, and the way that he approaches the game is nothing else if not well thought out. It would seem like the way that he went about playing the golf course, he obviously had a plan, as we're sort of saying, in mind. I was talking with another senior writer at Golf Week, Adam Shupak, a few days ago, and I mentioned to him the idea that if you're going to have relatively narrow fairways, and from what I understand, the fairways were kept at the same width as the members would play on a week-to-week tournament. They didn't pinch the fairways leading into the U.S. Open. That's what you get. But they did. They drilled five wells over the last couple of years at Wingfoot to make sure that they had enough water to get that rough really lush and really thick, which, as you were here in the Northeast this last summer, it was dry, it was hot, but that rough was really, really thick and lush. If everyone is going to miss some of the fairways, some of the time, then it would stand to make sense that you would want to be further down in the fairway. If you're going to hit, say, nine fairways and miss five off the tee, I'd rather be 30 or 40 yards further down, all things being equal, than to be 30 or 40 yards further back. When you design a golf course like that and you set up a championship course like that, it would seem to most people to make sense, like, oh, if you want accuracy off the tee to be rewarded, make the rough thick and make the fairways narrow. Okay, that would seem to make sense. But am I wrong in thinking that when you set up a golf course like that, the longest hitters actually do get an even bigger advantage?
Well, the longer hitters will get a bigger advantage. And if you remember back to Jeff Ogilvie's win and Phil Mickelson's debacle on the last hole, the last time it was at Wingfoot, the fairways were so narrow and the rough was so long that it ended up being a short game contest by and large. And Phil, the way Phil hit the ball back then, he had no business standing on the 72nd tee, you know, with a lead. But he had arguably one of the best short game weeks of the year. So I think in terms of golf course setup, you know, you try to take away one thing, but you end up realizing that after the fact, you've created a different kind of examination. I think that if I were to set up a golf course, given what these players can do today, I think everybody would agree that you can only hit a 4-iron out of certain length rough. Once it gets 4 inches long, mm-hmm. you can't hit a 4-iron out of it. No one can. You can only hit an 8-iron out of certain length rough and a pitching wedge out of certain length rough. And so I would graduate the rough length, not from narrow to the fairway out to the ropes. I would gradually increase the length of the rough as you got closer to the green and pitching wedge yardages. So I would have it be a foot long at 100 yards where you had a hard time getting a wedge out, you know, and I have it 8 inches long where you have a hard time getting an 8-iron out. And I'd have it 4 inches long where you'd have a hard time getting a 5-iron out. I would make it fair for everybody at every length in the sense that if you miss a fairway, you're going to all be penalized the same amount, regardless of the club you're using.
Well, as I talk to Adam, and I will also confide in you, I had a chance to talk to the Golf Week 4 caddy when I was at Winged Foot, and he was telling me that idea is definitely gaining a little bit of momentum in Far Hills for the people that would ordinarily be around the water cooler in Far Hills if they were able to be in their offices, which right now they're not. But that idea of graduated rough, not from a width perspective, but from a length perspective, is definitely something that is being looked at and is being investigated. That whole concept that you're saying is that if you want to bite off 325 yards of fairway, okay, but the penalty for you missing at 325 will probably not be as severe as the penalty of somebody hitting it 290 or 295 who misses width-wise by the same degree. The idea being that that your distance is... You're imparting more risk on the guy who's trying to hit it farther.
Several years ago, Butler National Golf Course in Chicago went through a remodeling. And Tom Fazio redid all of the bunkering. And as I went around the golf course and looked at it, I came to the realization that if you were in a bunker that, let's say, required a 7-iron to get out of, he gave you a lip that you needed a 9-iron to get out of. If you're in a fairway bunker that, you know, you had to hit a 3-iron, he gave you a lip that required a 5-iron. And so the lifts on the bunkers were punitive in the sense that you had to hit an absolutely perfect shot to be able to get it out of that bunker and on the green. And so that's when I first realized that, if a fairway bunker is 100 yards, it's going to have a 10-foot lip, mm-hmm. and you got to hit a lob wedge out. So I realized the penalties that you design into a golf course need to be commensurate with the club that you're going to be using from that particular part of the golf course.
It makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. What from a standpoint, because you've had a chance to see a lot of these players up close, and you've been watching obviously this year quite a bit on TV. What changes have you seen in Bryson's swing as he has become physically larger and is trying to swing harder?
Well, a couple things. First of all, I'm impressed with how far he's hitting it, but I'm even more impressed that he hasn't lost any of his accuracy. That's unbelievably incredible that he's able to do that. He's maintained his flexibility. I see that he has increased his range of motion of his lead shoulder in the backswing. And then in the through swing, which is the first crank arm of the golf swing. So his swing is longer. He has more wrist set at the top because he's swinging back faster. And obviously when you put the brakes on at the top, the club head keeps going and you're going to set the angle a little bit better. What he's done is he's added strength, maintain flexibility, and maintain explosiveness in his ability to fire his muscles. So he's obviously studied this, or has people around him who have studied this, and his training regimen, I think, is spot on for what he's trying to accomplish.
Which sort of leads me then to the comments that we heard from Matthew Fitzpatrick several days ago, basically saying that and you and I have talked about this a little bit before, that that Bryson is making a mockery of the game. That that Fitzpatrick's saying, and I'm going to really shorthand this, he could put on 40 pounds of muscle. He could try and bash the ball farther down. But in his opinion, that's really not what the game of golf is all about. That that there should be elements of finesse. There should be elements of skill that, in his opinion, Bryson is sort of trumping with this approach. Where do you come down on those types of comments, and how do you see the other players, I guess, this reaction? Do you think that most of them share that reaction? I saw Justin Thomas coming out supporting DeChambeau, who's, you know, a Ryder Cup and President's Cup teammate, and the two of them will probably play those kind of events for the next decade and a half at least. Are you surprised that there seems to be this pushback from Fitzpatrick and maybe some other players?
Well, I mean, there's always been this gap between the longer hitters and the medium length hitters or the shorter hitters throughout time. I mean, every superstar in every generation that I can recall basically separated himself from the field by being able to drive the ball brilliantly. Whether it was Ben Hogan or Sam Snead or Jack Nicklaus or Tiger Woods, they were all longer than everybody else. They were all better drivers than everybody else, Greg Norman included. And so driving has always been the separates yourself from the rest of the field, right? And then you can't discount the fact that Bryson, while I don't like the way he putts, I think that should be outlawed. If you're going to outlaw the long putter, then yep. What he's doing either. I just don't think that's
your criticism is that it's too vertical, that he's essentially the way that he is setting up and has his lie angle being, you know, it's not 90 degrees, but it's close, that should not be allowed.
Yeah. But it is. And he's not breaking any rule. I want to emphasize that.
No.
You know, he's playing by the rules. So I think that the USGA and the RNA screwed up big time when they tried to fix putting, get rid of the long putter and so on and so forth. But that's another whole subject. In terms of Matthew, you know what? He's got two choices. Everybody plays the game, should be playing it the best way that they can play, not the way somebody else is playing.
Mm-hmm.
And if he doesn't want to pursue distance, then he needs to make sure he really works on his accuracy and his putting. And his ability to win on certain golf courses will be minimized. And on other golf courses, like, say, Colonial or Hilton Head or whatever, then they'll be maximized. And he'll have fewer opportunities to win, but still he'll have opportunities to win. You know, the thing that also, David, that happens is that, and I've seen this with major champions throughout the years, that in an effort to get better, they lost sight of who they were and what kind of golfer they were.
Yeah.
You know, whether it was Curtis Strange, you know, after winning a major, he decided he wanted to get longer and get better. Ian Baker Finch, you know, Luke Donald. There's been a bunch of major champions who, in the pursuit of improvement, kind of cannibalized their style of golf. They just lost sight of who they were. Tiger even did it for a while. With all the changes that he made in an attempt to get better, for a period there, I don't think he knew who he was as a golfer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I would call everybody to think long and hard before you decide you want to put on 40 pounds, go to a 48-inch driver, and start to play the game that Bryson's playing. Bryson's playing Bryson's game, and that's what's making him successful. Now, somebody else, player XYZ, wants to try and play Bryson's game. It may not work for him.
Mm-hmm. To me, it's when I heard the comments and I read it and I sort of sat back and then I read it again, because I think context plays an important role in this. I kept going back to the fact that he said he could do this, I could do that, but he's opting not to, which case that's his competitive choice. If he feels that that the best way, and I agree with you, that for him to shoot low scores and to compete and hopefully win, that he needs to play a certain way, which it sounds like relies more on accuracy, good putting and short game, finesse, instead of, you know, trying to hit the ball, you know, 320 off the tee, launching the ball and doing this power game that, that DeChambeau does. And many of the top players in the world, if you're looking at the official world golf ranking, I mean, obviously at this point right now, Bryson is sitting there at number five, but Dustin Johnson, John Rahm, Justin Thomas, Rory McIlroy, these guys all move the ball off the tee. That's where the modern game has gone. If you're saying, I don't agree with that, you're making a choice. And that's fine. You can make whatever choice you like. But at the same time, as you stated, everything that DeChambeau is doing, including the putting, is within the rules of golf. There's nothing prohibiting him from playing this way or from anyone else choosing to play this way. It may not work as well, as you're alluding to, Pete, that somebody, like, I would think somebody like Brooks Koepka would seem to have the physique where he could go this route and it might work. Webb Simpson, it would, I would just guess here, probably not be as good for somebody like Webb. I could be totally proven wrong. But to me, it was, if you were opting to play basketball against the Los Angeles Lakers and you said that, you know what, I don't believe in the three-point shot. I just think it's wrong. I don't believe we're not going to take any three-pointers. But yet they go out and they shoot, you know, 12 of them and make them. You can't have a beef with it. The rules are what the rules are. You accept to play a certain way or don't. That's fine. But you can't hold it against somebody else who's doing it that way. And it seems like in some ways Fitzpatrick is sort of putting down one thing, but he's not willing to concede that there's nothing wrong with it, that it's within the rules. And I don't know. To me, it did come off as sour grapes. I know some people support the notion and the idea. To me, I just read it as someone who is opting not or making a conscious decision not to adapt and change, as clearly the game itself has changed.
Well, when I read it, and I made this comment when Bryson came back from the suspension to play on the PGA Tour, the amount of time, effort, energy, and money that he put into
amazing
making these changes was all-consuming. I mean, it was 18 hours a day of working out, hitting golf balls, studying, you know, whatever. And when I read Fitzpatrick's comments, basically it came across to me as I'm not willing to put that time and energy into it.
Mm-hmm.
I got other things I got to do in my life as well. And that's a question I have for Bryson, quite frankly, is how long can he maintain this level of intensity of working out, eating, practicing his game, et cetera, in order to maintain this style of play? Because this is really difficult to do, I think, on a 12-month basis.
I asked him that, Pete, at Northern Trust. I said to him, it would appear between the nutrition and the equipment and the philosophical way that you're going about playing the game now, you have literally pushed all your chips into the table on this. You can't kind of half-ass this approach where saying like, okay, I believe that this is the best way and the most efficient way for me to play and kind of not do parts of it. And he agreed. He came out and basically told me, he's like, I 100% believe this is the best way for me to play. It's going to help me in the long run. Week to week, I'm going to have ups and downs like other people, but I'm going to shoot lower scores if I do this. And I 100% believe, I admire the willingness to do it. I think you bring up an excellent point. For how long? We'll see. But he clearly has 100% put himself behind this philosophy of all this stuff. And to this point, I mean, again, a year ago right now, he was number 14 in the world. And now he's number five and he's got a major. It's hard to argue.
Well, yeah, I know. But see, David, you can't, he has no life outside of what he's doing now with his golf game and his golf career.
Yep.
Near as I can figure out, there's not enough hours in the day for him to have a life apart from what he's doing. How long can a person keep doing that? That's my question.
Yeah.
Does he I don't even know if he has a girlfriend or not, but does he have a social life? Does he end up getting married, having kids, whatever? You can't do all of those things and maintain this work ethic and this style of golf, in my opinion, mm-hmm. right? So this may be a shooting star that's going to be very, very bright for a brief period of time, but then it's going to flame out.
It's
certainly, I don't know that anybody can in this level of working out and intensity for a long period of time.
Especially
golf is a 12-month sport now.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be you could play for 9 months. Okay, take 3 months off, do whatever you. But now the way the tours run, that's not a possibility.
No, it's not. And obviously, we're going to talk a little bit of Masters here. We've got a major championship in a month, which is something very unique. And then we're going to have a much shorter break before we're going right back to the same Masters venue, obviously at Augusta National. One of the players I want to talk with you about who I think has as full a life as one of the elite players could possibly have is Rory McIlroy. And heading into the COVID-19 shutdown that the PGA Tour had to do starting on the Friday of the Players' Championship, Rory was arguably playing his most consistently high level of golf that we had seen from him in a long time. That kid was living in the top five. And while you can debate that he maybe should have closed the deal and won a little bit more, I don't think that there's anybody that was arguing that Rory McIlroy going into the Players' Championship was playing just about as well, if not better, than anybody else on the planet. Since the COVID-19 shutdown ended at Colonial, he has not been the same player. Do you think that there was anything changed, or what would you attribute to the fact that we're not seeing McIlroy at, you know, I give everybody who comes out to play on tour 2, 3, 4 weeks to get used to playing in front of no fans, to get used to the testing protocols that are now in place, to get used to the changes that we've had to, and that the players and the caddies and all the tournament officials have had to make in order to keep golf going. Like that took a level of adaptation on everybody's part, but it's been a while now and we haven't seen that kind of Rory McIlroy that we saw, you know, November, December, and then certainly going into the early part of the spring. What do you think is going on?
There's a whole bunch of stuff going on, and not the least of which is he had a pregnant wife mm-hmm. nearing the end of her pregnancy, and then now they have a child. And that is a life-altering event, as you well know. Mm-hmm. And you know, your focus is changed. You can't, and this is, again, what I go back to with Bryson. There's going to be life changes that will affect his ability to do what he's currently doing right now. And in my opinion, during the shutdown, you know, Rory, I know Rory is a absolutely terrific young man with the values that I subscribe to. He's going to do the right thing for the right reasons. And so I think he probably gave up a little bit of his golf to support his wife. And then obviously with the birth of the baby, coming back out, you're not going to be 100% focused on your golf game either.
Yep.
So, I don't discount that he hasn't played as well, but I don't think there's anything seriously, impacting his golf game apart from off the golf course changes, quite frankly.
So you've been coaching Paul Casey for a long time. He's now a dad. Did you, while he was awaiting to become a dad, or in the first few months after his, you know, he became a dad, did you talk to him about this stuff? Did you guys plan out how his professional career now might be different? Goals maybe needed to be adjusted. The level of commitment that he should expect from himself, or that you as his instructor expect from him, changed. Did you talk about that?
Oh yeah, we did. And you have to remember that. I mean, Paul was number three in the world around 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, unfortunately, had a bunch of injuries, went through a divorce, and all these things were off golf course, non-golf related stuff. A couple of the injuries were golf related, but the rest of them were snowboarding stuff and whatever. And so people started to question my ability to teach because Paul wasn't playing well. And that's just not a comparison if you don't know all the stuff that's going on in the player's life off the golf course, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So now he gets remarried. They're having their first child. And I relayed to him the story of Tom Kite back in the day You know, he and his wife had their kids, and all of a sudden, you know, they were traveling with him, and everything was great. But now the kids had to go to school, and it really bothered Tom to not be around. And he didn't really want to go out on the road. And I said, well, you know, here's what you do. You go win more. Then you can take weeks off. You know, go out there for 4 weeks and finish 30th each week. You're going to get X amount of dollars. You go out there, win 1 week, you can take 3 weeks off, and you're going to get even more dollars. And so Tom sharpened his focus and actually played really very, very good golf that first year when his kids had to stay home, couldn't travel with him, and he had to be out there by himself on the road. So it's a mindset that you develop, and you decide, okay, you know, when I'm away from home, I'm going to work 100% of my focus on my golf game, on my craft, and my livelihood. And then when I go home, I'm going to devote 100% of my time to my wife and my kids, my family life. You can't mix those things up, in my opinion, because you never get full reward in either category.
Yeah, I agree. I think that nobody probably did that better than Jack Nicklaus. Nobody did a lot of things better as it relates to golf than Jack Nicklaus, in my opinion. But for he and Barbara to have had the family that they had, for him to have the career simultaneously that he was having, the charitable endeavors that he was involved with, the golf course architecture business, which really got much more going as he was exiting the competitive stage. But to be able to mentally silo yourself is as much a skill, I think, for professional athletes when you are talking about home life, professional life, the training that away from the golf course that they have to do. There's always going to be, in my opinion, a level of selfishness that's required, but it can be budgeted. You know, when Dustin Johnson has to go and train and work out and put in the practice time in order to be the number one player in the world, that's time when he is not, you know, with his family. But at the same time, then when he is there with them, you would hope that the focus is on that and is not on golf. It's not on adding distance off the tee. It's not on the other things that are doing that. And is Nicklaus still the model, do you think, for a lot of these guys, or should he be?
Well, Barbara Nicklaus is the model.
There you go. Exactly.
She is just all world. And I think everybody that knows her, obviously that knows Jack as well, realizes that. So it's a team, right?
Yep.
That's what a marriage is. And Barbara allowed Jack the freedom to do what Jack needed to do to play to his level. And then Jack gave up a little bit when he went home and devoted time to the family, and it was a win-win situation for them.
Yep.
You know, so that's what Rory has to learn. Everybody has to figure out how to do it on their own. And sometimes, knowing Rory to be the thoughtful person that I know him to be, he's going to err on the side of his family, his new baby, and golf is going to take, if it needs to, a back seat for a period of time. And I think that's what's been going on. Now they'll get together, they'll figure things out, and I think he'll come back out and you'll see a new and improved Rory.
The Sneak is a true crime podcast from For the Win in USA Today, and this season is on a surfing champion whose life took a violent, tragic turn.
Within 30 seconds, they're both dead.
The Sneak, Murders at Whiskey Creek, is out July 29th, wherever you get podcasts.
I can see it. He is, I agree with you. There is no player out there right now, athlete at all, that I respect more for having put himself out there to try and be the best person that he can be. I think that he is a very, very well-rounded young guy. And I agree. I think that at some point, if you think that Rory McIlroy's stock at world number four is on a little bit of a dip, I would buy this dip with everything that you got, because Rory is far from done. I think that it's funny, you know, I've talked with some people about him and how quickly we forget that when he first turned pro and really made the big splash, 2007 When Padraig Harrington wins at Carnoustie, is sort of Rory's coming out party for a lot of people in the U.S. They see this amateur player coming out, and when he turned pro on the European Tour, the knock on him early was he couldn't win, that he would shoot these great scores, and he'd collect all these top fours, top fives, where he'd have a lead, but then give it up on Sunday, and then he figured out how to win. And then he figured out how to win a lot and started winning more and just putting himself in position. He finally breaks through, wins his U.S. Open at Congressional, and that opens up some floodgates, and then that sort of goes away. It seems like there have been very natural progressions and plateaus throughout his career, and if we're on a plateau or a slight dip right now, I'm not buying the fact that Rory is not going to, in pretty short order, start to come back, get whatever focus and balance that's going to be required for he and his family for him to be at his best, and then watch out, which is also what I've sort of been waiting for from Jordan Spieth. And we've been waiting for a little while on Spieth. What do you make of what's going on? Speaking of Team Spieth, what is your picture of what's happening with Jordan at this point?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a level of frustration that they haven't figured it out any sooner than, I mean, there's nothing to say that they figured it out yet. We'll have to wait and see in the next few weeks. But I saw this problem starting 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, when all of a sudden, and Jordan had a golf swing. Let me back up, and I'm going to get geeky and technical in terms of the golf swing for a second.
Please do.
To help you understand. In my philosophy, the swinging of the hands and arms and releasing of the club head should eliminate the right side of the golf course. The rotation of the body and the speed of the rotation of the body should eliminate the left side of the golf course. So when you get your hand and arm release and your body speed compatible, in other words, synced up, the ball flies pretty straight, right?
Yep.
And a few years ago, Team Spieth decided he was going to hit the ball farther.
Yeah.
And that's when ground reactive forces and using the ground as leverage and all of that other stuff came into the arena of teaching. It was the flavor of the month,
yeah,
kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was a trend, yep.
He started widening his stance, really using his legs and body rotation very, very aggressively to hit the ball farther. Problem was, he didn't have a grip and a release of his hands and arms that could keep up with the body speed. So the body speed outraced the hand and arm speed, hence the ball flies off to the right. And when he started to try and do that in his golf swing, I thought that there was going to be an issue here because you can't change one thing in the golf swing without changing the other things that it affects. They all have to be compatible. The gears have to grind together. You can't have them out of sync. And that's what I see with Jordan. I see more use of the body, greater use of the body speed, trying to use the ground force reaction that everybody talks about. And he's done that, but his grip has to a strong enough position to offset the increase in the body speed. That's what I see from a technical standpoint, you know? And when he's timing it, oh, it's okay. But when tension increases and the grip pressure increases a little bit and the hands don't release quite fast enough, you're going to hit that block out to the right, maybe only once, maybe twice around, but that's enough to separate you from the winner's circle and missing the cut.
So how do you, as an instructor, and I'm not asking you to sort of speak to Jordan specifically on this, but you've worked with enough players and you've been around players for a long enough time. How do you, as an instructor, keep a player from having a physical shortcoming or challenge, something that they're trying to work through, get to become a mental challenge? Because as you pointed out, and I 100% agree with, at some point or another, Jordan Spieth has got to have become so frustrated that the work that he's putting in with Cameron McCormick and the whole team has not, you know, given them the fruit. Like, there's a round here or there where he can probably see, like, okay, there it is. Okay, we got it going. And then a triple bogey pops up and he misses a cut. And then the next week, I mean, it's just one of those things where if you, when you're watching Jordan Spieth from 2015, 16, 17, he was impressive. I mean, like everything was there. The putting was always the thing that people focused on, but they forgot or didn't realize how elite a ball striker he was. He was never as long as Dustin Johnson or some of the guys that really moved it off the tee. But his iron game was so good, and he was able to get himself so quickly to that putter, which was always wonderful, that he could keep up with those guys. And when things started to go, as you're pointing out, in 2018, the fact that he only has five top tens in 23 events, the year before, 2017, he has 12 top tens in 23 events. And it just goes down and down and down from there until like you get to this year. And, you know, his numbers, if you look at where he is, the fact that Jordan Spieth was, you know, number 97 in strokes gained approach the green. At his peak, he's a top five guy. His putting was off. Other things are off. How do you keep the confidence and sort of the mental part of it separated from the physical part of it when the physical is just dragging on for so long it becomes frustrating?
Well, you have to get rid of the one thing that you're fearful of. That's what creates the mental block. You know, whether you're fearful of a high block to the right or a low duck hook, whatever it is, whatever you're fearful of, you have to get rid of it. You may introduce another error, but you say, okay, well, I can fix this one now that one's gone, and mentally you're a little bit relieved. But in Jordan's case, I still see the same miss, and that's what it starts to wear on you mentally, right? Mm-hmm. And so, again, you have to be careful what you wish for in this game, because sometimes in an attempt to get better, you lose your identity. And Jordan Spieth was always a very good driver of the golf ball, not the longest, not the straightest, but a pretty good combination of long and straight. And then he let his irons put the ball on the green, and then he let his putter do his talking. And now he's spending so much time having to work on his golf swing and his driver. Again, you rob from Peter to pay Paul. You take time away from the putting green because you need to use it to get rid of that block with your driver. And then your putting suffers. And now you're in a downward spiral all the way around.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, they need to go back and figure out who he wants to be, who he should be as a player. Because what he was when he first came out on tour what he was up until the last, say, 3 years, was a pretty doggone good player. And I know it's not from lack of trying with Jordan.
You know,
he's all in on effort. But they, I think, have just been barking up the wrong tree with trying to hit it farther in a manner that's not compatible with his original golf swing.
2015 FedEx Cup champion, 2015 Masters champion, U.S. Open champion, damn near won the Open at St. Andrews, wins the Tour Championship that year, obviously wins his Open Championship 2017 at Birkdale. It's a lot of positive things to draw back on from experience to give him confidence. And it'll be fascinating to see when he and everybody else, for example, show up here in a couple weeks. Now it's time for our way too early Masters preview section. I know you've been looking forward to this, Pete. What's it going to be like for you to watch the Masters on TV?
Well, it's going to be strange. I've done every Masters since 1990, so that's going to be weird for one thing. The good news is I'm not going to be looking over my shoulder to see if I broke a rule that I didn't know.
How many times over the years did I try and call your cell phone just to see if I could make it go off in 13 Tower? Do you know? Like I tried. I think it was like my annual, like that and pimento cheese sandwiches were my efforts.
Yeah, well, I'm dumb, but I'm not that dumb.
So I'm assuming you're going to be watching in Phoenix. What will you be watching for?
Well, the thing for me is what was always, I thought, one of the greatest qualities of the Masters tournament was there was nothing but players and caddies inside the ropes. And so when you looked, and obviously there may be one handheld camera behind the
sure.
player, but it was pristine inside the ropes. And, you know, you can go to the U.S. Open or the PGA Championship or the Open Championship, whatever, and there could be you know, with the leaders, there could be another 100 people inside the ropes,
yep,
cluttering up the image that you see, right? So I always appreciated the Masters for keeping it pristine visually. This year, to me, it's going to be really, really interesting because I think the weather is going to become a factor. I mean, it could be anywhere from 45 degrees to 75 degrees in November. Mm-hmm. We don't know where we're going to get yet. But mostly it's going to be no fans, no patrons. I think that's going to open up the door for Bryson DeChambeau. I'll go on record right now. People have already been asking me, what's he going to do at 13? He'd be able to take it over the trees and hit a wedge in. I said, you know, I don't even think he's going to go over the trees necessarily. I think he's going to drive it in the 14th fairway.
Totally. Yeah.
He's going to drive it up to the 14th fairway and come in from that angle, which is a great angle to come at that green from. So I think you're going to see with no people there, you're going to see players taking different lines, perhaps stylistically playing the golf course a little differently. Obviously, in Bryson's situation, the fairway is going to be 50 yards wide on one over the bunker. Two, he can drive it over the hill and hit a medium to short iron in. Three is three. Four, five is not much difference. Seven, he can drive it past the trees up by the green.
I started doing the same exercise, Pete, a few days ago when he was talking about the 48-inch driver and what he might do, and I was playing out the par fives in my head about if he is as straight as he has been, which is straight enough, certainly. There are lines. I mean, in 2014, when Bubba Watson goes up and over and on 13, and we really hadn't seen that line where a guy goes and clips and cuts the corner like that, and really, you know, that was the one where when he finally hits that shot and Spieth's got.
I have to say you now, because I was on that tower and Bubba did not go up and over; he went up and through.
that was quite a brave line, and a couple guys have now since then started that line. But there are going to be lines that we haven't seen, and I think it's what you're saying is true, and that with no patrons who are going to be lining that, the miss if somebody lays up, for example, you talk about 13. If guys go through the fairway on 13 or come up with something such that they're not going at the green, the play is to go way right on 13 into those mounds. And basically the end of the line of the ropes that keeps the patrons from getting too close to 13 green and really getting them down towards 14 tee box. That landing area now becomes where he could land a drive. I mean, he could try and hit it just a massive draw and send it out over there with his first shot, which is not exactly what Bobby Jones and Alistair McKenzie had in mind, but all over the place, as you mentioned, on two, on number one, if he just goes at it, that bunker on the right-hand side comes out of play, and that changes the whole complexion of that hole. But how often have you played, if at all, have you played Augusta National when there are no grandstands set up, no patrons around? What is visually, what does it look like, or how does it look differently than what people are used to seeing it on TV?
Well, I mean, there are no stands. They're called patron observation stands.
Mm.
Where the acronym is POS, but I'm not going to go there. so, you know, the TV towers are there.
Yep.
They're permanent, but nothing else looks like the tournament, you know. Mm-hmm. It's pristine. It's really nice. And I don't know that there are all that many stands. I mean, there are some around, but mostly it's the flock of people, you know, outside of the ropes, down by 8, 7, that area too. The people behind the green at 16,
mm-hmm.
the people are behind the tee at 16, rather, the people in that triangle area of 13, 14, those crowds and the people surrounding the 18th green, those are the ones that frame the visual for the player. And now that framing is not going to be there. So it's going to be a lot more wide open. And I think perhaps even a little bit more difficult to focus your attention where you need to focus it.
I can agree. I think that I'm going to miss and I don't think there's any way even the Augusta National Golf Club can recreate this, is the atmosphere and the tension, the sense of theater, when you have that many people who are cheering and the roars through the pines, and it's cliche, but it's cliche because it's true. You know, you and I have been to enough of these things, fortunately, over the years, when you hear a roar from someplace on the golf course, and based on the direction and sort of the time of day, you can kind of figure out who must be there and what that must mean. Because the scoreboards are not electronic the way they are at regular PGA Tour events. They're mechanical. Like, people will take down a cluster of three numbers, slide in the cards, and then pop them back up. And then the crowd responds to whatever news, because nobody's allowed to have their phone out there. You don't really know what's going on. That atmosphere that is created when fans have these spontaneous roars, when you get the oohs and the ahs, which is unlike any other tournament, is not something that we have been able to replicate at the U.S. Open. I mean, I was there. It felt like a really hard tournament. It did not feel like a major. It just didn't. At other events, with no fans, you don't have that sense of theater.
And well, it's a double-edged sword for the players as well, because if you go back, everybody remembers 86 and Jack Nicklaus and what he did on the second nine on Sunday, and those roars that he created with the shots that he hit and the birdies and the eagles and that he made obviously pumped him up. There's no question about that. But it also leveled some degree of fear in the people that he was chasing.
Oh, Seve and Norman felt it, for sure.
And it created tension for them. So now, that's not going to happen this year. May not even happen in April. I mean, we don't know what's going on with the pandemic and when we'll be able to go back and have full crowds at tour events, right, or majors, whatever. And so, yeah, it's an adjustment that's gonna, I think, be very intriguing to watch, especially on television. You're not going to get the excitement to really energize you, but you're also not going to get the roars that will put fear into people. And so it'll be up to the players to control their energy level and their destination.
How are you and Paul going to prepare for it? And are you going to go, or are you going to stay back in Arizona?
I'm going to stay in Arizona.
Okay.
No, I'm not going to go. He's playing this week and next week, and then he's coming back, and we're going to work on kind of what we always do. At Whisper Rock, they'll get one of the greens really, really fast, one of the practice greens, so we'll be able to work on speed with the putter. We've got some areas with uneven lie stances where we could practice, like the second shot on 10 or the hanging lie on 2 and stuff like that. We'll just work a little bit on some shots that he's most likely going to get. But mostly it's just going to be get all the homework done so that when he gets to Augusta, he doesn't have to worry about, working on this or working on that. He's freed up to get his mind organized about how he's going to plot his way around the golf course and how he's going to play and what kind of shots he's going to hit.
Obviously, it's a really challenging golf course. There's no reason to think that in November it won't be challenging as well, and we'll see what we're going to get from a weather standpoint. But would you agree that without fans in attendance this year at the Masters, at least certainly in November, that it could make it easier for a first-time or a relatively inexperienced by Masters standards player to win? Because, as you said, the roars are not going to be there. The sense of tension that comes from, Saturday and Sunday, I would think, is going to be as much self-created as it is what you actually hear, because you're not going to hear very much. I would imagine it'll be very, very quiet out there. Does that make it easier for somebody who hasn't really gone through it before to win?
Well, I think Colin Morikawa answered that at the PGA.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, Bryson at the U.S. Open. I mean, they both won their first majors, right? And when you're there and there's no crowds, then you're not really experiencing the true intensity of a major championship, right? You go to Augusta and you play with a member, and it's great. You have fun, and it's good, cool. But there's no crowd around, none of this, and the first-timers this year at Augusta are going to get there, and they're not going to really experience the Masters. They're going to be playing a tournament at Augusta National Golf Club, and it's called the Masters, but they're not going to be in the Masters because there's not going to be 35 or 40,000 people around there.
Yeah,
it's going to make it easier, I think, for the first-timers, and I don't want to say necessarily harder for the veterans, but it's going to certainly create a void in their memory bank that they kind of pull shots out of to get through a certain situation.
It's going to be like nothing else we've seen, and there's been a lot of that in 2020. You know, so it just sort of stands to reason. But as we were going around Wingfoot, there were people in their backyards. I mean, they kept showing Rick Pitino had bleachers, you know, behind number 3 green. There were people behind 10 along the side of 11. There were people at 4. And it was a small thing, you know, but it was sort of this little tip of the cap to like, okay, people actually are watching this. There is not going to be anybody at Augusta National who isn't supposed to be there or isn't credentialed to be there. The number of media is going to be very small. I don't know from a production standpoint how many limitations are going to be put on CBS in terms of can they bring as many crew to put on the broadcast as they typically would do, or if that's going to be, I would assume, a smaller number than they would have done otherwise. But it's going to be a small group. It's going to be real quiet. It's going to be much more like what we saw, for example, at TPC Boston, another venue that you know, where there are no houses. There's nobody there on that great big property. There's not going to be anybody there at the Masters either. I think it will be fascinating to watch. It's a real treat. It's going to look really different too. I would imagine it's just going to be multiple shades of green. We're not going to obviously get azaleas and magnolias and dogwoods and all that kind of stuff, but I can't wait. I think it's just a treat. It's something that hopefully we have earned the right to have fun with this. And then the quick turnaround. Do you have to hustle out to get yourself a new iPhone 12 now?
I'm going to order it online. I'm not going to. I've stayed with an old one for a while and it's cracked, and it's I've been hanging on waiting for this one to come out. So
there you go.
But I will say this. I do think I don't think there'll be much in the way of limitations on CBS from the Masters Committee.
Good.
In terms of putting on the production, because I think they realize that the only way the world is going to see the tournament this year is from watching on television. And so they're going to want to do everything. If I know them like I think they know them, I know them, and they're going to want to do everything they can to maximize the viewer experience for this unique event. And I'm sure CBS is going to be there. I have no way of knowing. I haven't talked to anybody, but I'm sure CBS is willing to put up all they can to it as well.
The word that I heard on general media also is that there's going to be a few more people than there have been going to regular week-to-week PGA Tour events, in part because the media center is so big that you can socially distance relatively easily in that media center. So I don't know how many outlets are getting how many credentials, and this is getting way into stuff, but I think that there will be a little bit more robust coverage than we have been getting otherwise on site, and there will certainly be plenty of remote coverage that's getting done as well. So hopefully people can still get, you know, all their Masters fix in November, and it'll be interesting to see it, because obviously we know the tee times are going to be moved way forward because it's going to be dark at around 5:30 in Augusta, Georgia in the middle of November. Pete, it's always a real pleasure. Thank you very, very much for coming on the Forward Press. I look forward to doing it with you again real, real soon.
Thanks, David. Take care.